Welcome to the 110th Smartcast, released for November 2012. This is the multi-sport podcast for triathletes, duathletes, sportive riders, road racers, time trialists, runners, mountain bikers, and fitness enthusiasts.
Whatever your distance and whatever your event, this podcast aims to make you smarter and faster.
Thank you for downloading this 112th, 12th, 10th.
I was going to say, we've gone up to already.
110th episode. I'm Joe Beer, Coach Joe Beer, and I'm joined by Martin Crocker. Can I preempt that with anything?
I don't think you need to.
Okay, fair enough. Right. How are you?
Very well. Good. Very well. Now the darkest depths of winter is here.
I know. Look at this. In the summer, 8:15, it would be a balmy summer's evening
in Corfu.
In Corfu.
In England?
But in North Devon, it would be still raining.
Yeah, it'd be wet. But, oh well, can't have it all.
Thank you, everybody. Still 50 episodes up at iTunes. They won't take any more than that. So there's a few gradually dropping off the catalogue. I think we've got about 4 more of Toasty left still on the back catalogue. So make sure you listen to some of those, because a good bit of Toasty from time to time.
Never done anybody any harm.
No.
Yeah. I have spoken to him a few times.
Have you?
And he's doing all right.
Yes, he's been sending me texts and emails and the like. So Toasty, you're welcome back at any time, in limited quantities. right, reviews. Thank you very much. Those are those are always nice to have. We have 2 from the last time we gave you an episode. I'll do number 1 and you do number 2. So first one, which was from Margaret Mussolini on the 13th of October 2012. And she says, "The Downward Spiral," and gives us 3 stars. "These podcasts are pretty good, but having listened to pretty much the entire back catalogue and there's been a decline in the content through 2012, the enthusiasm seems to have gone and there seems to be a definite decline in the use of information. Sporadic delivery and pretty much everyone has been disappointing this year. Have moved on to Training Bible and Ben Greenfield, which is, in my humble opinion, are far better. Q&As are few and far between. No decent interviews. Pull your socks up, boys." Okay. Come on, Martin.
I know. Well, Margaret, I do apologise. What we'll do is we've got to do something better, yeah.
I have to say, every month I've printed out Q&As and we've spoken through Q&As and we've gone at length through Q&As. So I'm a little bit stunned. I mean, it might not be your topics, and it might not be perhaps you've moved on beyond certain replies, and as we were speaking before we started recording, it's difficult because you have to give certain generalizations, but it's also that the information is, you know, it's often at a personal level, but then I think you can often learn from really from taking other people's principles,
yeah.
And it's quite difficult to get decent interviews, but you know, we started 2012 with Rachel Joyce, and that was followed straight away by the Raylett brothers. And we're hoping for a few more, but sometimes getting hold of these people is not easy. And
I think as well is if you want the top guys that you've been interviewing, they had slightly more pressing issues to deal with, things like the Olympics and you know, world titles as well. So let's just say that
I tweeted before we went out the 15 pages that I'd already printed out and planned, and there was other things that were read through to get to that point. So don't think that we're not.
You've got to take the good ones with the bad ones.
Yeah,
so.
But also think, you know, we do take time to plan it out, to print out your reviews, so the reviews are up to date. We're working on one computer. There's another computer with the up to date iTunes reviews, so we're making sure we've got 18 ratings at the moment, and the average rating is a 5. Now, people might, you know, not all be happy, and we hope that if there are any slight disappointments, that we'll continue to make improvements.
Improvements, yeah, definitely.
It's always a case that, you know, you should never become blasé. I'm very, very, very aware of that. That you can't just sit back and just sort of say, oh well, yeah, you know, whatever. But we hope you will return and listen to them. And I'm still enthusiastic as ever. I love sitting in the little office and talking with you, Martin. Somebody did ask if we could do them weekly, and it would be lovely, but you or I haven't got the time to do it.
No, and as much as we love doing it as well, obviously we need to hear back, you know, anybody's gripes or, you know, questions and your Q&As. We can't get through all of them. It's impossible, really. And what we can do once we get maybe a bit more time is maybe just have Q&A, like we've done a few Q&As, just only Q&As.
Yeah, literally from the beginning to end.
Yeah,
the other thing to do is to look, I don't know whether it's ever possible to do an open Skype to see whether you could open up an open Skype, like an open mic, and have anybody call in, and then you record what it is you're doing. That must be possible to do that.
Yeah, definitely.
But anyway, on to review.
Margaret, thank you.
Second review.
We will try and crack on.
Second review.
The second review just says JBST, 5 stars, by Hutchie 1973. It says, quality. Have listened to the podcast for the past 3 years. Have gone back and listened to the whole back catalogue. Love the detail and the seriousness when it comes down to the technical aspects, but this is a well balance between the banter between Joe and Crocker. Listened to a number of podcasts, but this is the best for the latest tech, training and nutrition news. Only wish it was weekly. So thank you very much, Hutchie 1973.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you for that, Hutchie. And we hope that's that kind of balances the whole you can't please all the people all the time, and if you think you are, you're missing the point. Sometimes people won't like content, or they will like content. Another thing, and this was actually fed back to me, and it was about the podcast, but it came in via a forum, and somebody put me up on what was going on, and I think if I remember rightly, it was early on in September, and somebody put, and I believe that the title of the person's pseudonym was "The Older I Get, the Better I Was," and they said about I too listened to Joe B and Martin Crocker on their podcast. I do wonder how much really useful knowledge he has for the seasoned racer. A lot of his podcast stuff is quite frankly quite frankly common sense, in my opinion, of course. And I think that's probably some of the best training advice you can do, is the common sense, because you'd be surprised how many people try and outthink common sense. Right, 2 hours in zone one, and they go out and they do 2 hours and say it's too slow and go hard. Like, okay, that was common sense, wasn't it? There was a follow-up, and somebody might have got it wrong, but said, I like the podcast too. Big advocate of base work, no hard stuff in the winter. No, just controlled hard stuff. You know, you do the odd mountain bike race.
Yeah.
I like sometimes even doing the odd bit of interval work, weights work, something a bit different that isn't just, you know, don't go too hard. But there was then the follow-up, which said, from the older I get, the better I was, says, exactly, hardly groundbreaking stuff. No, okay, it might not be groundbreaking stuff, but you'd be surprised at the research that says you should stay in zone one, and yet the amount of people that are being coached or believe that if zone one's too slow, you go into zone two. So it might not be groundbreaking stuff, but it's the truth. And it says, and unless you've got 25 hours a week to train, possibly not the best way, and often hotly debated. Don't get me wrong, I do listen, but there are a few nuggets of wisdom that most wouldn't know. Wouldn't know already. And that's it. A lot of this, we aren't, you know, there might be the odd thing that is.
But then at no point, we've never turned around and gone, this is information, this is top secret, you know, we're letting it out there now. You know, like it was said, a lot of it is common sense, but like you said, a lot of people tend to forget about the common sense
The top secret stuff, I've got a document on my computer, seriously, of stuff that gets said or trickles down through teams or athletes. And there is a host of stuff that sometimes you can release it or you can use it in a different way. But, you know, the absolute best stuff is actually, it's like proprietary information. But it's not like we're saying, oh, we're going to hold it all back and not tell you. No, it's just like some of the stuff on the outer limits to do with some of the nutrition advances, some of the training regimes, and certainly some of the technologies that are out there. It's, you know, even today I've got some information about something. Like, no, I can't even say about that.
Yeah.
But what it shows is there is a constant evolution. And I wouldn't say that we're saying the same thing that we were 6 years ago when the podcast came out. There's certainly been some, you know, slight deviations, and it often isn't groundbreaking. This isn't about trying to create a massive revolution and say, look, everybody, this is how you do it. Yeah. It's all change. And it isn't 25 hours. I have nobody doing 25 hours. Most people probably fall into the range of maybe 7 to about 10 or 12. And there's the odd, you know, Ironman high level competitor, not even elite, just high level competitor that is up around, you know, approaching 800 hours in a year. And then there's some elites that approach 1,000, but those are the few and far between. And yet the base work with the right intensity works. There's people that are, you know, 19 minute time trialists that are doing it off of an annual yearly amount of about 350 to 400 hours.
Yes.
So they're not doing 25 hours a week. And yet they're getting results that other people are hankering for. And that's the common sense bit, is getting your training right. And it isn't more is better. And sometimes people don't like that. So they call this common sense.
Yeah. But again, say with being seasoned triathletes, you know, I know plenty of seasoned triathletes that still haven't reached their potential because they just can't quite turn the training round to the common sense training. They think it's common sense. Mm. But when you say to them, look at your training diary, your best results have come from when you've done this in your off season and came in slightly more refreshed, or you've done a bit more base work, et cetera, et cetera. You're less injured. Mm. And so, yeah, so to someone who's maybe been in the sport for, you know, 10 years or from when it started, it may seem common sense to you, but there's people out there that still look at it and go, I still don't quite get it.
But also, when you're 10 years older, you have to take into account, you know, are you 10 years older, i.e. what you did, your body cannot quite do now.
Yeah.
You have to be more reactive to perhaps life is busier and your body's older. And therefore, actually, common sense takes a lot of sometimes swallowing your ego, because you want to think you can still do what you did, but you haven't got the time or you haven't got the capacity to absorb it.
Yeah.
And there are plenty of athletes who've got wonderful training volumes. They'll tell you all about the amount of miles they're riding or time that they're training, and yet their results do not back it up.
Yeah.
I would much rather have the athlete that had less training time over the year but had the best results they'd ever had. Because it isn't who's doing the most in October, November, and so on. It's like, what did you do in the season? Did you actually get, you know, PBs or close to PBs, or, you know, PBs since you turned 40, or PBs over a distance you've done repeatedly, but suddenly got it better? And a lot of it is common sense, but common sense is very difficult to get right because there's all these conflicting views about what is great, what isn't. And I'm certainly not ultimately turning things into a great big change of mindset. I've always thought that base was the right thing to do as a majority effect, but we know intervals work, but they work very effectively and very quickly. So you don't have to be doing them now thinking, well, if I'm doing intervals now, you wait what happens in 6 months' time.
Yeah. When you're tired and shattered.
Yeah.
But there we go.
There we go. So I think, you know, it is important to, to sometimes be able to reflect on what is effective. And some people only have themselves with which they take all this experience. They haven't got people that actually have put money down and say, make me quicker. Because when it does happen, you have to focus like mad on what they're doing, because they don't just want to say, oh, well, that's fair enough. They want to improve. They want to be able to get better. And then you have to realise that there are loads of individuals and there might be different, you know, roughly different lifestyles, but there's not a massive difference in the training. If you looked at the proportions and principles in an Ironman athlete taking just under 9 hours versus a time trialist doing just under 20 minutes, there'd be lots of similarities. There wouldn't be like, oh, that's entirely different. Well, yeah, I know one's got to be on the bike for just under 5 hours and the other's on the bike for 20 minutes, but the principles of how they try to train are not conflicting. They're still aerobic athletes.
Yeah.
And, the common sense is listening to your body. It's looking at what resources you've got available. And it's trying to see that at the right parts of the year, certain things should be happening or shouldn't be happening. And I think it's very hard for people to switch off and to, you know, effectively go into a different mode. And, you know, the best thing now is when people say, oh, yeah, I don't normally do anything different, but I've started to do a bit of mountain biking or some cyclocross, not racing, just riding a bike off road. Yeah. And, oh, I've gone back to the gym. It's like, great, great. Keep it fun. We can still develop that, but it doesn't all have to be developmental.
That's the way.
Yeah. And one final thing before we go on to the... a little bit of homework I set you, Martin. Via Twitter, thank you to Alex Bell, who started a conversation about L-carnitine, and he said, why spend loads of money on maybes when sticking to the basics is cost-effective and tried and tested? And I absolutely believe in what you say. The basics are tried and tested. We know, you know, carbohydrate drinks, gels, just snacks and high carb foods help to fuel and refuel your muscles. That's an absolute. Then there's, you know, some improvements on top of that, such as recovery drinks and milkshakes. And then there's some of the more esoteric things, of which L-carnitine is one, but it isn't without evidence, and it certainly is being used very effectively by athletes up to, you know, very high level at Kona, shall we say.
Right.
Very high level. And it's not, okay, it's at a very minute level, but if I didn't talk about it, then I wouldn't be doing the groundbreaking stuff that somebody else is nattering on about.
Let's explain what L-carnitine is.
So L-carnitine is... I guess it's the best way for people to think about it is that it's a shuttle in the body. It allows the transfer of quite a few energy pathways are in effect assisted by L-carnitine. Most people will get most of their L-carnitine through animal-based products, but you can supplement with L-carnitine.
Right.
And for years, it was believed to be this great fat burner, because fat is one of the key things that L-carnitine helps to shuttle. But they never got the way to get it into the body when you supplemented right, so they didn't show the effects as they could be.
Right.
There's been some research done in 2012, and Alex very, very kindly sent me something I'd never seen on the net, which was 2006 data. But that 6 years between 2006 to 2012 has opened up a completely different pathway. A group of very, very intelligent and switched on sports scientists have looked at it, done repeated studies, and found that you can effectively absorb the L-carnitine and there is a measurable effect. So it does work.
Right.
I can't find it, but somewhere I've got an article that I wrote in 220, a very, 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 very long time ago. We knew then it worked. We didn't know how. We knew it worked because of the effect of people that were Ironman winners, Ironman record holders, were using it and saying, this stuff is awesome. I'm recovering well. I'm racing faster. We knew it worked, didn't know how. Now they kind of know how it gets across into the body when other people can't get it across into their body. So so I think, yes, it is an esoteric, right on the verges of being, you know, is it worth doing that? The protocol has a very high carbohydrate intake to get it in. And a couple of coaches that I have got Facebook things going on with have sort of said, oh, that's very high carbs. And it is. Okay, it is very high carbs. But some people have used that as part of one or two recovery solutions after training. If they're doing two or sometimes three sessions a day, that's what they take straight after.
Yeah.
So they are using it that way. And it does work. There is support to show it works. People that have been using it, I've had people using it not just a long time ago, but even within the past three seasons, that have found that it has really, really good effects.
Okay. So with reference to, we kind of, you know, you can obviously, you can get it as a supplement, as an additional supplement to a decent diet, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
But do you know, are you allowed to say what amounts you're allowed to take it in? And
I'm not going to say that now. No, I just think that's one of those things where I'm not locking it down.
Yeah.
You know, people have got people that I've given it to.
Let me sat here questioning you.
Yeah,
so, Mr.
Yeah,
Beer.
Yeah. No, I didn't know anything about the allegations. No,
how dare
different,
you?
That's a different no, but it's one of those things where, to some degree, that's what athletes at a certain level need to know.
Yeah.
And if you put it out there and said, this is what you need to take. But of course, you can get somebody that just needs to lose weight or needs to get other elements of their diet jumping on it. And then you could be rightly accused of saying you're just pandering to people's needs for supplements and not giving it in a priority way, which is get all these things right,
right, yeah,
be at a high enough level, then we will say, yeah, you need to use it. And the people that are using it are very much at the high level of their sport. They're not, you know, they're not just coming into the sport, they're not just people that really need to get the training and the equipment and the basic nutrition right. They're looking for that last 1 or 2%. And if it's 1 or 2%, then do it.
Yeah.
And yes, there's a cost involved, which is, when you work it out over the year, it's several hundred pounds. It's not just a couple of gels from time to time, it's several hundred pounds. But so is a disc wheel. So's you know, swimming in an endless pool every week. So's anything if you want to look at it. And so I'm not going to say exactly what it is, but I'm going to say that there is enough evidence and it backs up what other people have already said. And it backs up that, yes, you can always say, where's the 50 peer-reviewed studies that all show it works? These people have done it in such a way, it's not an accidental finding. It's absolutely rock-solid science. And it is a landmark study, and I'm surprised more people haven't noticed it,
yeah,
written about it, and started to say, look at this works. And there are, as I say, there are certainly very good athletes that've already been using this for a good number of years that know this works.
It's funny you should mention, because I've actually had a phone call today about L-carnitine, and yeah, and considering I didn't know your, you know, kind of your content, as it would be, so yeah, who knows.
Mm.
I'm having a look at that piece of paper when you finished anyway.
So there we go. What? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Friction facts.
This is
there you go. This is where Martin. This is where Martin gets all kind of right. Eat actually. But for the first time, he's come in with some notes. He has. He's got some written notes. I'm going to take a picture and we can put them up on the Twitter.
Oh, I sent you a picture. Did I send you a picture?
You did.
Yeah, yeah.
I might retweet it.
Yeah, but no one's ever going to be able to read that.
No, you sent it to me, but I thought you had a spider infestation in your house.
A note from my niece. But the funny thing was, I took a picture of it with the iPhone when I really could have just written it on the computer and just sent it to the iPhone.
You could have, really, Martin. Yeah, yeah.
Things don't move on. But anyway, Joseph, carry on.
No, you tell me. No, I'll start the conversation. Then I saw this come up as a sort of thing that flashed up my way. And then I looked into the info, and it was quite interesting because it's about chains and jockey wheels and stuff like that. And again, you know, we're at this tiny level, so don't think that this means that we're advocating everybody's got to go out and buy this, you know, extra expensive chain or, you know, spend... What did somebody say they spent the other day on ceramic jockey wheels? I was amazed.
It's crazy. They can watch anything up to 200 and something quid for the ceramic jockey wheels.
Yeah, and this Friction Facts, I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name, but you sent me some emails. I could find it out while you're talking about it. But the person has basically said, you know, that he's doing all this testing. There's a Friction Facts website, and it's very interesting because it's looking at things because people always presume certain numbers. And this person, okay, with certain limitations of any methodology, has looked at the particular friction in chains, literally out the box, with the same amount of running, how much, you know, are they like out the box, or, you know, what it's like if you clean them and then lube them and things like that. And one of the things about the ceramic jockey wheels was that, You know, even if you looked at the biggest spread between like really bad and good, it was like 1 watt.
Yes.
And you think, hold on a minute. Now that's where the 200 quid jockey wheels make no sense. And therefore, this is where I'm not saying, look, always spend stupid amounts of money. If you said you've got £200 for L-carnitine and £200 for the jockey wheels, I'd take the L-carnitine any day.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the priority of needs. But if somebody said, I haven't even got a heart monitor, well, don't get the jockey wheels, don't get the L-carnitine, get yourself a heart monitor. And there's always a priority of needs. But this was quite interesting because it puts some of those relative amounts into what actually is quite small. But anyway, you carry on and I'll let you have your moment.
Well, the thing that I mean, basically, the studies we're looking at, it was 5 or 6 different chains, wasn't it?
That's right.
Pretty much of the top, manufacturers out there. Some of them, even the ones that you don't see much on the market. But basically, tested them with the lubes on, then super cleaned them with a different lube on, and there was quite a bit of difference in the wattage that was produced, I suppose.
So it's Jason Smith at Friction Facts.
Yeah.
Sorry, that I couldn't remember. I'm sure it was Jason, but I didn't want to get it wrong.
But the notes that I were making, kind of looking at it, I mean, the top chain, for instance, that came out was a Dura-Race chain, wasn't it? A 7900.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the first thing that I have a tendency to do with any of my kit, especially with a new chain, is before it goes on, it gets cleaned. So basically, the manufacturing grease comes off it. I basically take it back to its bare dryness, I suppose, and then pop it on and then lube it up. So, but as you look through all the tests that he has done, so for instance, he's putting it in a 5311, so 53 big ring on the front, 11 on the back, to create the most friction that you would get. Because obviously the gear is tighter, the chain's got to squeeze through the jockey wheels and over the rear cassette as well. So, you know, it's quite interesting to see there was quite a bit of difference if you're looking for that small kind of, I suppose, gain.
Yeah, but this was with brand new chains. And I know he's going to put some data up on used chains. Because the amount of people that you and I know to change our chains, and the moment you get any sense of it not quite changing right at the rear mech, you're like, right, I'll have a new chain.
Yeah.
And you don't always automatically put on a Dura-Race chain, do you?
No.
On the best bike, I do. But on the training bike, it's like, okay, what is it, 25, 30 quid? What's the kind of, you know, bare bones chain? Because it'll do the job.
Yeah.
But it's still not like when you're, say, somebody walks in with a bike or somebody has a bike fit and you say, you know, how long has that chain been on? And they're like, oh, since new. And like, how long have you had a bike? Oh, about 2.5 years. You think, yeah, you've had a chain on for 2.5 years. How bad must that be in terms of not only it's wearing out all the other components, but then you're talking about a serious amount of sort of friction. And I know it's been talked about at the higher levels of cycling, and they talked about like 30 to 40 watts difference in chains.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, these are the notes that are kind of I made. You know, some of it is
rubbish.
It's utter rubbish.
It's utter rubbish, and you can't read it.
I'm looking at it, going, I'm not sure.
What idiot wrote that?
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Me, dolt.
But what you can't, with the chains, it's not a bad thing to have a look at yourself. But the notes that I made of importance was the cleaning of the chain and the bike.
Yeah.
So, for instance, I keep a race chain, and I keep a training chain. So, you know, you can't just, I know I'm in a fortunate position where you can, I've got two bikes. So I've got a training bike and a race bike. But you can't do all your training on your training bike and all your racing on a race bike. So you have to kind of, you know, when it's dry or a nice Sunday, and I'll take the race bike out, but I'll have a separate chain for when I race, because there is a massive amount of difference. You can feel it.
When are you going to break 23 minutes for 10 miles if you've got all these super fast chains on your bike?
I've got super fast chains. I didn't say I have super fast legs.
Ah, okay.
Right. There's a difference. But I've just put as a matter of importance, the cleaning of chain and bike, race chain, training chain, you know, the clean rings and cassettes that you can have on the bikes as well, you know, and the importance of it being clean.
Yeah.
And obviously bottom bracket wear and tear. Because what people have a tendency to do is they go, oh, your chain's running nice and smooth. And then it starts to stiffen up. And the first thing you think is, well, I think it's like it's either the cassette or the chain. Take the chain off, spin the bottom bracket. You know, if it doesn't spin freely,
yeah,
then you might have a few issues there, especially with the new bottom brackets, you know, right. Things like BB30s. The BB30s obviously use a 30 mil axle yeah. on them. And then obviously the bearing or 30 mil bottom bracket and then the bearing to suit whatever axle's going in through. They have a tendency to just roll on the axle instead of actually rolling with the chain set.
Yeah.
They see solid and then you're just running the chain set basically on the metal inner bearing. The bearing's not moving at all like it should do. So, you know, that's another maintenance point as well. And that all adds on to yeah. resistance. And then on the bottom, I've just put think chain line. So, for instance, you running it in the big ring at 53 and then run it on the 28 on the back, you think of the acute angle that chain is at.
Yeah.
You know, the friction that is causing.
And if you look at the rear mech, how much that is being stretched forwards.
Yeah, how much it's got to pull. Yeah. So you're actually... The resist, because all the mech wants to do is spring back. You know, yeah. it's keeping the tension on the chain.
Yeah.
So it's not like you want to keep the chain the loosest.
No.
But, you know, just things from this kind of friction study, you then go back to your common sense. And you go, oh, yeah, well, clearly if I run it in big ring on the front, big ring on the back, it's... number one, it's ruining the chain.
Yeah.
And number two, it's got to be causing more friction.
Yeah.
Than you necessarily need. Yeah. So, yeah.
And also there's that... The research that Shimano have done, and they found that when you had it in certain gears, you had a lot worse of a efficiency on the chain because it's either at extremes of big to small in terms of 53, yeah. 54, 55 at the front and only 11 at back. And one of the arguments for having bigger chain rings on the front is that we're not suggesting you're going to be riding any faster, but you'll then be able to use slightly larger gears yeah. at the back. If you run a 53-11 at the back, you may be better to run a 55 and then never need the 11. You might yeah. use the 13. There's probably 12 is as small as people should go, in theory.
Yeah.
But they often use the 11 because they've run out of gears. Well, maybe you need a bigger chainring on the front.
Yeah.
But if you go to small at the back and it goes ever smaller, and I've ridden a bike with a 9...
Oh, right.
Moulton.
That's right.
Moulton
yeah,
bikes,
yeah.
when they had Hoogie special hubs, and they had a 9. You could feel how much friction that made. Honestly, it literally wrapped round on itself.
Yeah,
you imagine
yeah.
there's only 4.5 links. Sorry, 4.5 teeth that wraps around. How small is that?
Yeah.
And so you could literally, as you change gear, you might feel like you've got a bigger gear, but you can suddenly feel this chain literally tugging you backwards.
That's right, yeah.
And so, you know, that went smaller because you had to, because you could only have such a certain size on the front before the chain ring was up by your toes. but at the same kind of, not physics, but the same mathematics is such that on a tiny 20-inch, or in that case, less than 20-inch wheel, you've got to have increasingly small rear cassettes.
Yeah.
So when people say, oh, you don't need sometimes as big a chainring at the front, it may not be because you think it's based on ego. It could be because they're trying to minimise the amount of smaller cogs they have to use at the back.
Yeah.
And a straighter chain line is better so that when you look from the front of the bike down, you can see the chain stays as straight as possible. That's far better than it bending off. The bending isn't too bad with regards to the friction on the chain, but it's what it does to the mech.
Yeah.
And Shimano find that tension on the mech is the most important factor in keeping the chain running smoothly.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a really, really old and knackered mech that doesn't work very well and doesn't pull on the chain, that slap and the lack of tension in the rear mech will actually be really bad.
Yeah. So kind of, it is really interesting, actually, even for someone like myself to have a look
with numbers in it and graphs.
Yeah.
And graphs.
Oh, and I like graphs.
Do you?
I like a man that uses colour and graphs.
Yes.
So it is well worth a look.
Yeah.
And then
was it frictionfacts.com?
Yeah. And from that, you can then take, you know, even a simpleton like myself, even a person like myself can look at that and go, well, yeah, that kind of makes sense, doesn't it? It makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just from a friction point of view, like Joe was saying, it's also from a maintenance point of view.
Yeah, yeah.
You run a chain for long, anything longer now in the winter, say for longer than 500 miles, I think some of them, if it's not well looked after, get it off.
And then, and I don't, to be fair, on my race bike, on my trainer bike, I don't look after the chain.
No, I don't. I don't mind.
And then I put a bit of lube on it, spin it round, and that's fine. Maybe even get an old T-shirt and clean off the stuff. I don't spend 20 minutes cleaning and redoing the glue. Is that what I'm going wrong? Putting glue on it.
That's it. That's why it's a bit stiff.
But I think Friction Facts start to put, you know, I've talked earlier about coming, no groundbreaking, no common sense. This is common sense that I bet there are people out there that have bought their super duper 100 and something quid ceramic bearings, and this across various brands. And if you want to, you can, you know, buy the report online. It's about $5.
Yeah.
And there's various brands, and until you even get to, you know, about maybe the 10th brand along, you don't then even move off of something that's effectively less than about 0.4 of a watt.
Yeah.
So it's so minuscule, you could actually look at some people's jockey wheels and think, I've calculated it, some people could have spent 7 times the amount on the jockey wheels than they needed to for exactly the same gains.
Yeah.
Now, that is common sense, and the report's up there at Friction Facts. Save your money and, you know, spend it on something else. And there's always arguments for, well, some people like to spend it on stuff. Fine. I love people to love their sport and to buy themselves treats. But at the same time, I like solid data from which to make at least some reasoned guess as to the best place to do it. So you can pretty much get good results on ceramic jockey wheels at about £30 but you know what, that's not going to change your training. But if it's something you put on and you've always had, you know, below par jockey wheels because you bought pretty cheap componentry on your bikes, well, spend £35 on some decent jockey wheels, and then when you get to race day with a new chain, okay, and your new jockey wheels, you will notice the difference in how smooth that feels. Because if you've literally had a racer trainer bike that's done it all, the whole winter, and then you race on it, I bet you could even hear those chain links going around the block. And therefore, this is going to save you some energy for what could be a lot less, because it's not like you don't use it anywhere else. You use it on your dry rides, on your races.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's something that's been and gone and one race and it disappears. This is something that's there, and there's no reasons why you can't, and there are people that will take their race chain off the moment they think that they're going to be having really bad conditions or they finished for the next few months. They'll take it off, it's in good nick, and they use it again the following year. Okay, that'll only go for so long, but it doesn't mean one chain has to be totally wrecked.
For the amount of damage that a worn chain does, not only the friction, but, you know, all right, for instance, a 10-speed block now, you know, 40 quid for a cassette on the back. And then you look at the chain rings. The chain rings are at least that, 40, 50 quid that. You know, the cost of a new chain for it all wearing that out, you know, and a decent 10-speed chain is about 20 quid.
Yeah, yeah.
So what I do with mine is I have two training chains. All right. So
say that fast.
Training chains. Don't, because they're not my teeth.
You practice that.
And a race chain. Now, the race chain comes off of the race bike. It then gets cleaned. It gets lubed. And then it gets put away. Whereas
Scott, you must have an exciting house, mustn't you, eh? I bet Kirsty's like, what's this tin? Oh, no, that's the race.
Well, what's the race chain? Put it down, sweetheart.
Put it down. That's out of your budget, love.
But the training chains, I mean, I know it sounds awful, but I don't look after the chains as well as I should. But I know for a fact that I can go home, if I look at the chain and go, oh, that's looking a bit ropey, I can just flick that one off, put another one on, and I can either check that chain, see if it's stretched or not, or just go, I'm not going to bother, throw it in the bin.
As your mechanic, Blake Pond, as he said on the conversation that's up and running on the Facebook page, he said people should get themselves a park tool chain measurer.
7 or 8 quid.
Yeah.
7 or 8 quid could save you the best part of 100 quid.
Yeah, you learn how to measure your chain and to be able to effectively know when is too worn, because these things, you don't ride on a chain till the thing eventually snaps because you've literally broken a link.
Yeah,
it's way off. It's like, you know, driving your car tire until you get a blowout to say, well, that must be pretty low, mustn't it?
Yeah, and
it's
all the never time checking the oil.
You've got to have a certain amount of maintenance, and chains are one of those simple things that I know it sounds like when people say, what, you literally do it every, I think it's probably 3 months or less. It's got to be.
Oh, yeah.
Easy. And yet, now. Every 3 months? Yeah. It's only £20.
Yeah.
You know, what
well,
do you do?
Especially in the winter.
Yeah.
The winter, you just go through them.
I would say you almost break it up into the season. So at the end of the season, and when you start back onto your, if you're, doing more outdoor cycling, you can then put your, first winter chain on, which may well be a racing chain that's not worn out, but is now going to become a training chain.
Yeah.
You use that through the first part of the winter. You get to about December, January, you have an overhaul, which should be straight away put a new chain on. And then that will take you pretty much to the end of the winter. And then as that bike starts to be used less, you start to maybe go out in better conditions, use a different bike. If you've got only one bike, well, then you change it before you get into your early races.
Yeah.
And you're looking at, almost literally every quarter, you're changing the chain.
Yeah.
And it'll be a better one in the summer, and it'll be a bread and butter one in the winter. And that'll be, even if you said, that was one 60-pound chain in the summer and £20 in the winter. Okay, we've just said you're going to spend £100 on chains, but you could easily lose that on your cassettes and rings.
Easily. Yeah. So, but honestly, it's well worth a read. It's interesting, some of the little studies that Jason's done on it. So, and it's things to think about as well. Things to think about when you're training, when you're racing, a chain line, jockey wheels, this stuff wears out because, you're putting the power and the pressure on it. And it's all these little things added together that kind of enhance your race results, can take you from a, like Joe says, it is the icing on the cake pretty much.
But it's not if you abuse a chain and you've never done it, you don't realise how much you're losing.
Yeah.
It's the same as when people say, oh, tyres, they don't make much difference. And then you get them to spend a little bit of extra money on their race tyres and they go, oh my God, I didn't realise tyres made a difference. Yeah,
this is it.
Use them in the summer. When it gets to end of the summer, start doing your winter training, put some slow, really kind of, sticky tyres on and ride through the winter.
Yeah.
All of this, there is little differences, and the point I wanted to make was about the jockey wheels. Look, here is common sense, because you can spend an awful lot, and I've heard through sort of feedback via pro teams, they reckon if you do jockey wheels, bottom bracket, and both wheels, that you might get 5 to 8 watts total.
Yeah.
Which, when you look at, if you even stretch the numbers on the jockey wheel, if you look at that data, you might get 1 watt on a really bad jockey wheel set to the very most expensive.
Yeah.
But not even the very most expensive. Some of the ones that were about £30 still gave some of the best results. But how much are ceramic, when you start talking about ceramic hubs for wheels?
Yeah, I know, they're stupid, aren't they?
Yeah, and they might give you another couple of watts. So actually, the jockeys, because they're moving so fast, may well be one of the places where, if you think ceramics really do work and you want to get into that technology, spend 30-odd quid.
I just wrote a note here. I said it was surprising.
No, that's not a note. You're making that up. I can't read that.
Well, that says pulleys.
Right.
But they span, Jason, span the cranks to drive the pulleys, obviously, at 95 RPM in 5311.
Pulleys?
Yeah.
Jockey wheels.
Jockey wheels. But they span the jockey wheels at 458 RPM. At 95 at the crank.
Yeah.
So you think of how fast those jockey wheels... I'm not saying that you
have
to go...
What about if you're cycling at 458 RPM?
That's what
how fast are the jockey wheels then going?
A lot.
About
very fast.
1,600 times.
Yeah. Well, you think the speed of the jockey wheels
going
round...
Yeah.
Then I think that's when ceramic bearings do come into their own. I understand this. But you look at what your incremental gains are, spending your money up against the wattage that you gain or save, depending on what way you look at it.
Yeah, yeah.
You'd be better off to spend it on a new chain.
Yeah.
And then your icing on the cake being, your ceramic bits and bobs. So.
Particularly if somebody's got wearing out pieces, but it still changes good, it may be that they look at the jockey wheels and think, actually, those are the only thing wrong with the mech.
Yeah.
The mech's actually, from a changing perspective, works okay. It's probably, every year they take, 2 nanograms off the weight of it, so some people will want to buy it. But if it still does its job, the one thing that's actually been taking a lot of wear and tear, which people don't think about a lot of, is actually changing the jockey wheels.
Yeah.
And so if you're looking for places to think, well, hold on a minute, how long have they been on there? Unless even they have been properly serviced, there might be a load of gunk in there.
That's the thing. You take the cages apart on a rear mech, and depending on what...
So apologies for anybody that's getting bored at this point about Martin and his jockey wheels. Yeah. This is another afternoon at the Crocosphere household.
Yeah, yeah. And you take the mech apart, and you can actually take, depending on your rear mech, the covers off, the pulley, the bearings out, clean them, put them back in, and they run super smooth after that. But it's still
but only if you haven't got any television. Only
if you've got nothing else in your life. Even if you wanted to stare at a painted wall, then. But you know, all this is all about cleaning. It's all about maintenance. That adds to the fact that you then, when you get your race bike out, or it is race prepared, even though it may be your training and race bike, you've just gone, right, I've done everything with that bike I can do.
Yeah.
So there's nothing more I can do. It's me now. It's up to me. What can I do? So.
And it reiterates that you can never ignore it, because people have said, oh, chains are 98% efficient, and you can kind of effectively ignore that. No, it's the place where the power's going through. It drives the back wheel. As you say, the jockeys are going around at 450 RPM. Like the tyres, you know, they're your only contact point on the road. There's lots of places on the bike that may not be attractive, but there's certainly gains to be had. And if you're fine, and if you're already on top of this, and if you always do your chains, then great. We've spoken, hopefully, a bit of common sense for an amount of time that just reiterates that you know that it makes sense. And there are people that, you know, they do. They measure chains that are not in these, not like Jason's done in a very kind of, you know, clinical way. They do it on the road with different ages and types, and they've come up with much greater numbers.
Yeah.
I hope that we're going to get some data via Jason, because I want to pay for some testing, because I've got a hunch that if you take the average person, whip their jockey wheels off and their chain and then send it to him and get it tested, I think it'll blow people's minds how out people are, because they're not using brand new, they're not using good jockeys, and yet they're looking for every little bit, and they're quite easily spend it on, you know, a super expensive, you know, piece of carbon, and not realize there's something
fundamental. Just the thing that they take for granted.
Yeah.
Which is, again, another thing about the jockey wheels is...
Don't point to your notes. I don't think they're notes. They're scribbles.
Is the some people stop and go, well, why should I pay £250 for a Durace rear mech? Well, the difference between a Durace rear mech and, for instance, a Tiagra rear mech is they use different bearings in the jockeys. You know, one is a upper double bearing, and the bottom one on a Durace is like a single bearing. So that works out as being totally an efficient way of running the chain through it, but also it handles the load and the wear and tear more.
And if you go into the Friction Facts and buy it, you can actually, they compare the upper lower friction of the jockeys and work out exactly where, you know, where there are differences in, or where they're not differences. And no, and it's kind of almost slicing hairs, but until you have numbers with which to have a starting point, this is clinically clean and great. Most people are at dirty to horrendous. Therefore, how much they lose, I mean, massive, absolutely massive. And I think then you're starting to realise that any factor that isn't at least considered can become a big factor
if you don't
consider it. And this just highlighted that there's some things that people are wasting their money on with, you know, super duper expensive flash bits that are, you know, teeny tiny and insignificant. And there's other areas where if you say to people, you know, every 3 months do the chain, they think you're bonkers. They actually say, well, don't they just keep going? I mean, the metal, it's like the metal in your cables, unless you're on electronic, but if you're on normal shifting, that metal stretches. Yeah. Eventually, you have to either get them adjusted or get them changed. So everything on a bike, like things in a car, doesn't last forever. You've got to sort of update things.
That's the thing. So,
and a good bit of homework, Martin, by the way. I think you get a...
Can I have a C at best?
No, I was actually going to say a B-minus. Oh, thank you. B-minus for presentation.
No,
but an F for your notes, because if we actually put a picture up of those, people are gonna wonder. I mean, look at that.
I started writing wattages down, but I don't think people
know that. Anyway, I think that's really good, actually, Martin. Well done, and thank you, Jason.
Yeah.
At Friction Facts, good to just, you know what, start getting that stuff out there. There's been, you know, there's a raft of other stuff to do with other mechs and jockey wheel sizes and stuff. And I think that could be stuff that once you get somebody doing baseline testing, it's like the people have done baseline testing for rolling resistance. You've got people testing things, but at least the people are testing it. It doesn't just go from the, you know, the kind of big I am saying, oh yeah, well, you know, ceramics are the best and stick them on the back wheel. That's the back wheel. Stick them on the, you know, the jockeys and then spout some ludicrous number, which no proof, no, nothing, but, you know, I think it's flash, therefore I should do it. And this is getting it back to the raw, somebody doing the numbers. He brought all the equipment himself, as he states in his thing. There's nobody looking over and making sure the results are correct due to their company providing products. He buys it all and he tests
it. That's right. And he's an ex-terror athlete.
Ex-terror athlete, yeah. And, you know, some people are interested and they take that and they use really good science. I'm sure there's bits that could be improved upon, and I'm sure he'd love to do it across loads of different ratios and combinations, but I think the starting point is if people get interested in it and start to, you know, look at that data and even buy some of the data, you'll see that, you know, something like that can grow. And then we'll look back 5 years ago and go, wow, haven't we learned a load about, you know, how jockey wheels are much bigger and how, you know, actually you need to do a race bike every 2 months, but a training bike every 5 months or something like that. Yeah, yeah. It's gonna teach us a lot and it shouldn't be ignored. And if you've got an expensive bike with expensive, you know, Q-rings or even, you know, certain carbon rings or things whereby there's a lot of money in your transmission system, the last thing you want to do is be wearing it down because you want to be a cheapskate on your chain.
That's it.
You know, and say, what, £65 for a chain?
That's the thing, but you pay 300 odd to go into an Ironman. You come out of transition, you get on the bike, you push on the pedal, the first deal you come to, bang, chain goes.
Yeah.
That's your lot. For the sake of 25, 30 quid.
I carry a chain breaker.
Yeah, but even that, is in your head, would you turn around and go, oh, is it going to happen again if I go uphill? Because all I've done effectively is push a pin in where it shouldn't have gone in. If that makes sense. Because a lot of these chains you can't break.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Thanks, Martin.
Apart from the fact being catapulted over the bars, I've done it on my mountain bike. It's hideous.
Yeah, picking teeth off the ground.
Yeah, it's not good.
First Q&A. This is from Eamon Sheridan, and he did this via the Facebook page. And he says, nutrition question. Team Sky and Garmin have both been open on the web about how they use real food to supplement sports bars and drinks. Homemade rice cakes seem popular. My question is, what advice would you have for integrating real food into a feeding strategy for, say, an Ironman or 100-mile time trial or a sportive? Oh, and that's actually from Deborah Sheridan. So sorry, that was under Eamon's name, but Deborah wrote it. Real food. There's been a head-to-head against people having bananas and water, and people having energy drinks. They might even had gels as well, but it was a head-to-head, and the performances were very similar. They didn't have to run off the bike, and I think if you eat enough bananas and you try and run off the bike, I mean, come on.
Fiber
shouldn't be something you try and put in too great a quantity.
That's it, yeah.
But yeah, real food, and often on winter rides, I think it's a good idea for people to take some of their carbohydrate in real food to actually digest it, to actually get the body breaking down, particularly if it's a protein-based food. Protein takes more to break down. Therefore, your body actually creates, it's about a quarter of the calories from breakdown of protein foods are actually turned into just release of heat. So in eating protein foods, not only do they make you feel fuller, but they actually, in effect, waste some of their own energy being broken down into the separate amino acids. So often eating a bit of real food is quite nice. You know, gels and bars are just, for most people, a way of getting it down in a convenient way or in a taste that makes them feel like it's something that they like. Some people hate gels and bars and they will eat malt loaf or a banana. I think the important thing is that you take into account that particularly on longer distance races, you're going to have ups and downs with what you consider to be tasty and or palatable. Because what feels tasty when you're sat down may, at the moment, you know, doing nothing, feel like you want to eat it. 50 miles into a 100-mile race, you might not think that that thing is something you want to eat. And therefore, your whole palate changes and what you want to eat changes. And a lot of the times, Ironman and sport eats, when people stop and feed, and certainly in 100-mile time trials, when they have hand-ups and people that are there, effectively their mobile aid stations, they have to have a variety at the ready.
Yeah.
Because it shouldn't be, I'm just going to eat this and that's all. Because if you, on that day, need something different, the last thing you want to think of, oh, well, I've still got, you know, 16 gels to go and I'll just eat that. You know, variety often for people allows them to mentally break it down, because they say, oh, yes, at, you know, let's say, you know, at 50K, 100K, whenever it is, they will almost have like a treat food. You know, they'll eat something where I say, well, at that point, I'd like, you know, people eat, you know, a mini Mars bar just because they like it, because it makes them feel good. Okay, there'll be people that, you know, will now have fallen off their chair and say, you can't eat Mars bars in sport. You can. You can eat a lot of things, but you have to take into account that you need carbs, you need to feed the brain, and you need it to be something you can repeat and not have it repeat on you.
You don't want
to just say, oh, I ate it and then I was sick a few hours later. And I've known people go all the way to Hawaii and all over the place, and they thought they'd got the nutrition right, and they get 3 hours, 4 hours into race and they start puking, and they thought they'd done everything to get this right. They tried different combinations, different things, and it goes wrong. And I think what they do with certainly with the pro teams is they still supplement the sports bars and gels. They don't try and make them eat all of it, but they make sure that some of it is in real food.
Yeah.
Because they're on the bike for 5 or 6 hours sometimes on real long stages. They need them to be having something that psychologically lifts them a bit. I mean, they're still, you see, drinking a heck of a lot of bottles. You've only got to see the domestics ride from the back of the group to the front. They've got a lot of water and sports drinks on board, but they're also having these little, you know, snacks that they take out of tinfoil.
That's right, yeah. Well, I did a little bit of reading on the Sky released their, what they then thought was, well, they didn't regard so much as being groundbreaking, but there was reading through, there was far more fat in their diet than I think, it didn't shock me, but you looked at it and you went, that is a lot. You know, that's I think they were saying, I can't remember if it was like 40, 60, but there was, you know, not of complete fat, but a lot of their riders, they gave in high training blocks, they gave or allowed them to eat certain food which was relatively high in fat. They just saw that they recovered better, the stores filled better, they seemed to get, you know, the illness wasn't quite so bad, injuries weren't quite so bad. And that was just one small thing where I think people get a bit tricked into it, going, well, there's a lot of fat in that, you know, I'll put on weight. You know, these guys are training 5-6 hours a day, you know, and they'll have a couple of days where it's a little bit less.
Yeah. And what they get done per hour is, you know, their cruising rate might be, you know, they're easily, on very easy days, they're doing 200 watts.
Yeah.
On much harder days, they might be averaging 300 watts for 5 hours. Well, you consider 300 watts is like 1,200 calories for 5 hours. I mean, it's a massive amount of calories that they take
they
out.
They have to polish off.
So 7,000 calories with 5 less hours now in your waking day, and they might have, you know, 8 to 10 hours of sleep. You start realising, there's not a lot of hours left to do all that eating, is there?
No, that's the thing. And with answering kind of Debbie's question is, I think, again, like you were saying, you have to have a balance. You have to balance. It can't all be gels. It can't all be sports drinks, you know, because sooner or later, especially Ironman. I mean, I've spoke to a few guys that have done Ironman races now this year, and just kind of, I'm quite intrigued by, it would be something that I'd never do, ever. I put my hands up now and just say, you know, it's beyond my mental capabilities, rather like arithmetic. But chatting to these guys, I'm quite interested when they get to their dark place, and you just say, well, what were you thinking, and you know, what was your thought about, you know, your eating? And a couple of guys have said, I just wanted salt and vinegar crisps. That's all I wanted, was salt and vinegar, a packet of salt and vinegar crisps or a Marmite butty. Speaking to Nick Craig, doing 12 and 24-hour kind of mountain bike racing, he says, we just kind of get up and make a bacon sandwich. He said, your body just craves for fat. And he said it's just that kind of salty meat that you kind of you want. So I think as long as there's a fantastic balance, and like you said, you're not getting then two hours down the line thinking, good God, I feel ill. Yeah. I think you can try different scenarios, but I think it gets to a point where you have to have variety to make it, number one, I suppose, mentally acceptable, but number two, it's got to be palatable and you've got to look forward to it. Mm. So, I think, you know, as long as your homemade stuff, it doesn't have to be from a sports nutrition brand, you know. And
people used to, I remember somebody who first sold me some of his racing bikes, and it was in the era when, you know, the hand-ups they'd get for long time trials was, you know, rice pudding or just rice-type things. And they would then, you know, have to waft it down, or they would stop and quickly eat a load of sort of rice pudding and off they went. And that was sports nutrition.
Yeah.
You know, you had rice because rice was high carb and that was what you have. And, you know, you can see rice cakes coming into it. So, you know, kind of rice was along those lines, but it's the fact that you have to teach the body how to take this stuff in training. You have to consider that's part of training. When people say, well, so what do I do on the long ride, as if they've got to do something special, some of the times you're seeing, but how long can you actually take on board food before you start noticing your stomach or your brain both start to shut down and you go, I just can't hack it? And sometimes that's because it's the wrong composition, or somebody literally has a limit as to how far they can
go.
And they just say, my body doesn't do very well after this distance. Otherwise, everybody could ride, you know. You could take their 10-mile time trial and you could take whatever distance up to Ironman or up to 100-mile time trial, up to people that do 12 and 24s. Mm. And I've helped people over 24-hour races on the road time trialing. And, you know, they go through so much ups and downs. You just need stuff that still is the right stuff, but gives them the chance to have some variety with which mentally... especially something like that, you know, you're involving caffeine as well, because they're also getting tired at times. And I think it's about using it, but what Sky have got is people that are writing it down and noting it and working it out. You don't want to go too far into it, you start losing kind of the passion for food. I mean, I love my food. I love different, sometimes quite bizarre foods, but I like it, and I think it's really nice. I don't like cooking it, but I love eating it. And I like to experiment nutritionally and to try slightly different theories that people do. But it's all about making notes and saying, right, I had this many grams of carb, this many grams of protein, and I rode for this many hours at this. And what was it like? And sometimes you just go, oh, I was in bits, I got that wrong. And other times you go, wow, that really does work. And what you can't do is, you know, start to sort of have the perfect food or a perfect plan and not make any notes on how it's actually affecting you. If you're not noting what your power is or how well you recovered or even how far you went on how many grams of carbs or whatever you ate, if you aren't making notes, you've got no way of knowing whether this works, because you might accidentally get a good day and then say, oh, yes, but on that day, I definitely ate, you know, roast beetroot at lunchtime. And then think that every time you want to have a good ride, you've got to have roast beetroot at lunchtime. But it may be nothing to do with that. You might have ate well because you didn't have any riding for 2 days or any running for 2 days anything.
Yeah.
You got on the bike and you felt good. So I think you have to have notes in order to compare. And things like 100 milers, time trialers, even some of the demanding sportees, you don't get enough chance to actually test it. So every time you do an event, you've got to make good notes afterwards as to what worked and what didn't, because you're not going to be able to do that time and time again every couple of weeks to see when it works.
Yeah.
You've got to make notes. You've got to make notes in training. And one of the sessions I often give people across all these disciplines is the, you know, practice your feeding, you know, go out and ride for as long as you will. Even if you do it in multiple loops, so you come back home every two and a half hours, and therefore you can go off on different loops, but come back, refuel and off you go, unless you've got somebody that's going to come out with you and fuel up. But actually put this to the test. Because you don't want to put it to the test on race day with a lot of sort of hypotheticals, but no real knowledge as to whether you can hack it. Because otherwise you do get the vomiting and the, you know, the bizarre, oh, I don't know what went wrong. What did you do? Well, I tried something a bit different this time. Oh, okay.
You try spaghetti bolognese.
Yeah. Yeah, your body gets very used to processing certain foods and certain things. And in sport, the parameters of digestion, where less blood is going to your gut, where you may well be stressed by the event and by situations in the event, the last thing you want to do, particularly if you're one of those sensitive gut people, is start mucking around with things that you've never even tried.
Yeah,
some people literally can just... I can literally throw anything down when I'm racing or eating. Okay, you don't want to throw too much down in something that, you know, you don't need to eat something ridiculous if you're only riding for an hour. But if you're doing a sportif, if you roll up to somewhere and they've just got loads of different foods, if you're too picky and you say, oh, I can't eat this and I can't eat that, then you've got to think, can you or have you never tried?
Yeah.
Or if you can't, haven't you got the stuff for yourself because you realise you can't have what could be... I mean, sportifs could be a million different combinations of what you rock up to. You could just rock up to literally, you know, two old biddies and a cake stand, and that's your feed station, is a load of cake. I mean, that would be heaven.
Oh, yeah, don't get me wrong.
I'd love it. We're like, bring it on. Like,
Ron, right, you can have one.
Yeah, sorry, nobody else is going to have any of this. Yeah. Come.
Yeah.
Yeah. We done that one?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. This one was one we almost did last time, but we're going to do it this time now. So over to Martin for his best BBC voice.
So this one is from Steve Faulkner, and it says, "Hi, Joe. Great podcast, and I've been listening for a few years now since I took up triathlon. I was just listening to the latest podcast, which Joe's put as 109, whilst doing some data analysis. And it was great to hear that you mentioned the study I've just had accepted in MSSE on the hot pants used by the track cycling team in the Olympics."
That's medicine, science and sport and exercise, okay?
There we go. "Was interested to hear your thoughts on warm-up practice and the influence of body temperature on differences in seasonal training." Joe's highlighted this, and it says, "If you'd be interested in following up on this, feel free to drop me an email or give me a call. Looking forward to hearing from you. Cheers, Steve."
So I think, if those that weren't aware of it, this was, I guess it was less of a question, but it's a question about following up. And I think I think we'd be quite good to see if we could even, you know, do a podcast interview on it. But it's this whole idea that the track cyclists were using warm-up pants to try and see whether they could sprint better. And it was in the Olympics, and the Aussies had done totally separate. They claimed that nobody knew about what the other lot were doing, but they were all thinking about it, that they warm up on the inner part of the track, and then they basically got to sort of sit around for a while. So they had these pants that literally could come off at the last minute. And because they were warming the muscle, the study which they had done showed a big difference in the ability to sprint. So... some of them had like heated units in, others had, you know, various ways of keeping the muscle warmer. And there seems to be a few sort of spin-offs to this, but it seems to suggest, I think, that I sort of turned it around and thought, how many times have I heard of people that have warmed up, got cold, stood on the start line, running, time trials,
triathlons? I remember doing this, that's right. Yeah,
do you?
Yeah, yes,
yeah,
I do.
Yeah.
Because we were saying how it worked for the cyclists, but then we were looking at the sprinters, weren't we? We were talking about whether it would work or have the sprinters got something like that.
Yeah.
That's right.
And I think it's that thing that, you know, this probably isn't going to be, you know, the gadget for the triathlete or time trialist or even mountain biker. But you think about it, that there's lots of instances where we don't have that much warm weather that you always on the start line going, God, isn't it hot today? You don't. You kind of often feel like, just got to keep warm. How late can I take my kit off? Can I drop it at the line? Can people go to Ironmans? They've got their, you know, wetsuit on. They wear an old pair of trainers down to the start of the swim because they don't want to be stood on cold, wet surfaces. Last minute, they flick the trainers off, and that's then better than the person that stood in the cold, what becomes mud rather than a field. It's delayed. Half an hour, they're stood, 7 o'clock in the morning, on cold, wet mud. Who's going to be in trouble? The body starts to get colder.
Yeah,
this is one of those things where, hey, you know, first rule of Fit Club, you know, at least 3/4 of your training is in zone one. The second one is never get cold. This is even at the last minute. Don't get cold. Keep your body warm. Look at you know, some of the time trials that we see that literally will ride back down, get to the start. They've got about 30 seconds. They're held up and off they go. They don't get cold. Some people will stand there literally for 10 minutes getting cold.
They've warmed up. Cold.
When you warm up, you get all these blood vessels dilating and letting go of heat. If you could stick one of those guns, not guns, sticking with those guns. One of those machines that when you point it at objects shows where you're losing heat. If you stood there normally, you'd lose some heat. If you put it on somebody that's just warmed up, it would be absolutely, I mean, all of their surfaces would be getting rid of so much heat.
Yeah.
And then you stand there and you'd see their body temperature gradually get cold. And obviously, if you get cold, vessels that are meant to be eventually, you know, not only getting rid of heat, but also circulating the blood to the muscles, will be starting to shut down. And this was quite interesting because he'd sent me that and I'd seen, you know, the research. And I think it, if nothing else, it reminds us to, you know, to stay warm. And there are people that, you know, sort of say, oh, no, you can train in shorts all year round, stuff like that. Well, no, clearly you can't. These people are in velodromes. They are indoors.
Yeah, that's it.
It is a warm environment. They've warmed up correctly. They're a fit person. And still they gain a massive amount by keeping their muscles warm.
Yeah.
So it was the other day where it was definitely, you know, something like 8-9 degrees. Okay, I know that's not cold if you're living in Scotland and that sounds like summer, but it was 8 or 9 degrees. Okay, which should be the weather at which people have got tights on. Okay, yeah,
8 degrees.
8 degrees. Yeah.
Lord.
Yeah. What winter tights? You would do, wouldn't you?
Oh yeah, I wear them right on up to about 15 degrees.
Yeah, so do I. But most people. This person was riding the other way. He was probably about, I guess he was about 15, 16, something like that. And he had like white, tiny cycling shorts. His legs were also as white as his cycling shorts. But I just thought, you must be freezing. Yeah. Absolutely freezing. And it isn't, oh, that makes you harder. No, it doesn't. It doesn't make you harder.
It means your muscles work more efficiently.
Work more efficiently. You're more likely to make silly mistakes. You're more likely to have to work hard just to try and even stay warm. And you're missing the point that the effort shouldn't be, oh, is training about trying to be as warm as possible? No, it's not. So it's training about trying to stay as warm as possible. Well, yes, it is, but by using the correct clothing.
Yeah.
And this, you know, this kind of argues from the other direction that says even very good athletes in environments that aren't cold need to keep their muscles warm. Yes, they're sprinters, but that only magnifies the effect. It doesn't mean it only accounts for sprinters, because if you want, we can set a scenario up and people can try it and say, okay, go to your next race, warm up, stand around for 20 minutes and then see how good you do in your race.
Yes, that's it.
You know?
Well, it's funny because having reports from a local sportif,
you sound like a news reporter now. News report.
But it started at 7 a.m. Now the weather was horrific.
Yeah.
You know, it was cold, it was wet, and it was windy.
You mean the beast?
Yeah, the Exmoor beast. And to watch some people go off from the start with short fingered gloves on, is it fair to say some of them had arm warmers on with short sleeve tops, so no windproof, no waterproof, and shorts on. And I was chatting to the guys going, well, at what point do you think that they've just gone, I'll warm up in a minute. All right, fair enough. There is a little flat ride and then it goes uphill. But once you're up on top of the moor, that is it.
But then you come back down.
You come back down and it is open. And all I was thinking was, all right, I know everybody can't afford clothing, but surely at some point you wouldn't go out walking on the moors in shorts and t-shirt thinking, well, I'll get warm as soon as I get you wouldn't do it. You'd have a waterproof jacket on. You might even have proper walking trousers or waterproof trousers. But do you think of the wind chill that you get as you cycle and you're wet and the wind is blowing?
Well, it I think it's something like on wet skin at 9 degrees, when you get up to close to sort of 15, 20 miles an hour, the cooling effect at the surface is like at zero.
Yeah. And for your muscles to want to work properly and for you to think that you can work harder to get them warmer, it just doesn't happen. You just run out of energy, you know, like that. And
you're not using energy just to stay warm.
Yeah.
You need that energy to be riding the bike.
Riding the bike, pushing the bike forward pretty much. And what happened is that some people that were planned to do the 100 mile got to basically the halfway point of the 100K and just went, I can't do this. Gibbering with the cold, freezing. And, you know, a couple of guys that I know that have done it had to give clothing to people. Because,
well, I tell you what, at that point, that clothing's really expensive. Everything's gotten zero added to it.
And then, of course, you just think,
you want top, mate?
I got your top. But just kind of giving someone a jacket and then going, oh, that's loads better. And then thinking, a grown person, probably, you know, I would say 60-70% of them have children or have families that they look after. You wouldn't expect them to then go, oh, yeah, I probably did need a top. Well, I normally get really hot, but wouldn't you take one with you as, even if it was a gamble, then, yeah. Oh, I don't really want to carry that extra weight.
But there's enough midpoints of clothing. You can get it pretty right, even on wet days. Yeah, I mean, on wet days, you're probably still going to be wet, but you're going to be wet and staying warm by the fact the layers keep you warmer. I mean, it's the worst combination of wet and 100 miles, clearly, and cold, yeah.
So from this, with Steve's information there, you know, a well-trained athlete in a warm climate or indoors is still keeping warm, wants to be there as warm as possible for the muscles to function. So don't then think that going outside, riding in 5 to 8 degrees in shorts and t-shirts is beneficial.
I'm like you. It literally has to go above 15 before I start thinking, might take I'll start off with legs and see if I get warm. Yeah. If I do, I'll roll them in my...
I might roll an arm warmer down. That's it. Yeah, that'll do.
Yeah. Always keep warm.
Yeah, always keep warm. And it's showing to be beneficial for the... If you think it's slightly beneficial for the top-end guys, then it's got to be beneficial for us guys kind of that aren't on pro contracts. So.
Or contracts, even.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, question number 3. Dave Crossley. Thank you, Dave. Dear Joe and Crocker.
Thank you.
Got your name right. Thanks for a great podcast. I've been listening for just over a year and picked up some very valuable training advice, which has been a huge help towards a successful second season in triathlon this summer, including completing my first Ironman.
Well done, Dave. Well done,
nice
Dave.
Nice one. I have decided to focus on middle distance triathlons next season. I try to incorporate 2 or 3 morning sessions before work. I only have time for a 45-minute session. I was wondering if you had any suggestions for run and turbo sessions to make good use of my time. I'm doing the bulk of my Zone 1 work during evening and weekend sessions. Would you suggest using the short morning sessions for high-intensity work, technique, or something else? Your advice would be greatly appreciated, Dave. Well, Dave, the moment I saw this, I thought I wouldn't associate the morning sessions with trying to do high-intensity. We know that just from the point of view of the body's temperature, this is going back to temperature again without realising it, but the body's internal temperature is better... capable of efficient muscle use later on in the day.
Yeah.
And often you do more technical, or not even necessarily endurance. You don't have to think of, oh, it's only a 45-minute session, therefore it can't be. You know, if you're in the pool for 45 minutes in the morning, fine. You know what? That would still be, you know, an endurance session, because if you're doing middle distance, well, that could, if you, you know, sometimes even got in and warmed up and then swam a straight, you know, warmed up for 8-10 minutes and then swam straight 35 minutes, literally with a quick cool down, you could still treat that as an endurance over distance swim. If you want to do turbo and run, why not just, you know, hop between the two and break it up?
Yeah.
I wouldn't think, I've only got 45 minutes, better go fast. You could do your higher intensity work in the morning, but it'll still, I think, in the morning, it's like any morning race. You don't really even start to contemplate what you're going to do before, at least 20 minutes warming up.
Yeah.
And the thing is, then you've then left yourself with less time to try and do a useful session. Whereas if you're doing a lower intensity warm-up, there's still a warm-up, but it doesn't have to be quite so extended. And actually, technical work can be done in the warm-up as part of the warm-up.
Yeah.
So the whole thing can be technique-based. If it was run and turbo, if you had rollers, you could do, you know, technical warming up on the rollers, then hop off, go for a bit of a run. The lack of time shouldn't be thought of as a way of trying to condense it into a higher intensity. You can do high intensity in the morning, but I think it's very useful to make sure that really that the sessions are thought about in terms of what you've got to get done in the week. Not, oh, it's a short session, what hard session can I do then? It'd be better to say, well, I don't know, I could always do, it's mid-distance, so, you know, you could do 20-minute turbo, 25-minute run. That's still 45 minutes.
Yeah.
You can't get any more out of that 45 minutes by going even harder every time. You'll just turn more of it into potentially zone 2. I like the turbo session. Sometimes it is in the morning, but it's not early morning. You warm up, give yourself a good 20 minutes warm up, and then you do 6-minute blocks of, you know, real high intensity, and you have, you know, 6 to 8 minutes off in between, sometimes as little as 4 minutes. And then you cool down for a few minutes at the end and you're off by 45, 50 minutes. But, you know, that's a once a week as you get nearer to the season.
That's
it's
it.
Certainly
that's
not,
what I was gonna say,
oh,
yeah.
That's the mainstay of winter, yeah.
Because that's the thing, is you need to time when you want to do the more interesting stuff. And it is more interesting, the harder stuff. But you want to be looking closer to your season start or your racing season start,
yeah.
Before you start to incorporate this kind of training. But don't, I think sometimes, well, to joke and correct me, I suppose, is I think a lot of people that are pushed for time, that like to do well, that like to do their training, have a tendency to grab these kind of little segments of free time that they've got, and they tend to probably put too much effort into it too early. Just because they think, oh, well, I'm really limited on time. You know, when you're closer to your race, then maybe you can never make up for time, can you? You can never make up for lost training time. You know, it is what it is. You've just got to move on. But yeah, it's don't be too fixated on the high intensity stuff just yet, but don't obviously ignore it when it gets closer to the race time.
Because if it's 45 minutes, there's only so much you can do in 45 minutes. And actually, it's quite nice if you're doing a double day where you've effectively said, you know, sometimes you'll do another session in the day. So why not, you know, for half Ironman, why not do a 45 minute, you know, lope along, really easy run in the morning, then do a second run in the evening, but where you might run for, say, an hour, where you warm up and then you do a 30 minute right at the top of zone one, quick tempo, and then cool down towards the end and spend, you know, hour 30, hour 40 on your feet that day, but split over two sessions. The benefit in the second session is you've already pre-fatigued the day by the fact that you've run for 45 minutes in the morning. It's not that you've run fast, you've just run in the morning. So you start in the late afternoon, evening to do your second session. You can feel that. It kind of reduces as you warm up and you notice, oh yeah, actually I don't normally do two runs, but that's getting easier. Then when you get into the session and you start to push it a bit, you then notice that first session in the day has just left your legs a little bit shy, but you're not trying to find an hour 30, hour 45 in the day to do that session.
Yeah That's it.
Okay, final question, as we approach around about an hour 20, this is from another Dave. This is from Dave Hutchian. Do you think that's Hutchian? I think it's Hutchian.
Yeah.
Joe, he's not put the word Crocker, but I'll add it in. Joe and Crocker.
thanks, Dave.
Right, that's take him off your Christmas list. All right, and it's getting close. It's getting very close. Love listening to your show every month. Only wish it was weekly. Oh, another one. No, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. But I'm sure you have day jobs to do. Yeah, shall we explain?
We do.
Not only is it the most informative, but also the banter between you and Crocker is spot on. Oh, so he does mention you. Yeah, but just not in the title. Anyway, my question is always is as follows. I have 7 years triathlon racing. I'm 39, 5'10", 73 kilos. And my focus for next year is a couple of halves and Olympic races. Normally sub 5 hours for the half, 35 minute swim, 2:30 bike, 140 to 150 run. So very solid. I'm then looking to get back into racing for an Ironman in 2014. Well, just a thing here, Ironmans are filling up very quickly. So if anyone wants to do an Ironman, even 2014, be ready next year to enter very quickly.
Within the first like 15 minutes, isn't it?
Did you hear about Ironman Florida?
I heard it, but I couldn't tell you. I know it sold out very, very, very quickly.
1 minute.
It was 1 minute, I was going to say. I didn't know whether it was 5 minutes
so
or 1 minute.
So think about it, Dave, and anyone else doing an Ironman. You have to think 18 months ahead, because next year, whenever that thing comes online, you've got to be ready to enter then.
Yeah.
Not think about it. Some people have thought about it now, saying, oh, I'll do, I think somebody said the other day, I'll do Windsor, full. Oh, I'll do Bristol, full. Oh, I'll do Florida, full. You've got to be very much on the ball.
Yeah.
Anyway, previous Ironman UK in 2009, he did splits 120, he put disaster, poorly paced, bike 5:58, well paced, and enjoyed it, and then the run 3:40, well paced, dropped off in the final 5K. So that's solid, 3:40, 5:58 over that course, that's good. Training week at the moment. Oh, this is going on a bit, Dave. Training week at the moment, due to family, 7 to 8 hours made of 2 or 3 swims of 40, 50 minutes, 2 bikes, 1 long-ish, 2 to 3 hours, 1 turbo. Run 2 to 3 of them, a long run of 90 minutes and shorter runs of 40, 50. On to the question. Numero uno. Part A, section B, subsection C. No, just 2 parts. I'm keen to train at less than 80% heart rate max that you adhere to through the winter months up to March, April. Should even my shorter sessions be at less than 80% heart rate max? When riding stroke running hills, should I really back off so as to maintain the less than 80% heart rate max? So that's part one. And then second part, I'm considering going to a sports lab to get heart rate max test for both run and bike. What should be asking for, looking for, to find out rest period between tests and testing protocols? So I think first thing, I like what he says about, you know, to go through the winter up to sort of March, April time. I think that just makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
I know some people sort of think you've got to be doing the high intensity. There's so many people that don't, that get the good effects. I'm not going to say you cannot do it.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to be the mainstay of the week. The mainstay of the week is just trying to get some stuff done. As the light and the conditions and that gets harder and harder, actually being able to train consistently gets harder and harder. And then shorter sessions, some of them could be above 80% max. There's no problem in, you know, one of those shorter runs of 40, 50 minutes saying, okay, I'll warm up for 15, 20 minutes and then I'll do some, you know, either short power hills of, you know, 50 meters, exaggerated effort, but not sprinting, but just more power than you could sustain for several minutes,
yeah.
or longer hills where you work quite hard and work hard up the hill and then jog down slowly on a slightly lesser incline. So, you know, that would be an example. Sit on the turbo, do a little bit of, you know, over geared work against a resistance at sort of 60 revs and grind out maybe, you know, around just less than 50 mile time trial power, you know, that kind of grinding that shouldn't be high heart rate, but is strength work.
Yeah.
But not to think he's got to stay 80% all the time.
I think that's the biggest thing is it's not about, it's the 80% is there as a guideline of where you should train up to.
Yeah.
But if you go over, you know, you're not going to get shot. You know,
you will if you do it too often and pretend that you're staying.
This is exactly it.
Yeah.
The problem is do not kid yourself that if you go over 80, coach is going to shoot you, or you go over 80 and my season's finished. You know, if you constantly train or kid yourself that you are into your zone one and it's consistently over or up the top to over into zone two, then yes, you are just kidding yourself. You've got to basically turn around at that point and just say, all right, yeah, I see. You know, no one's telling you to take the whole fun out of training and just do the really easy stuff because it is boring. It is boring, but this is your bread and butter. This is the foundation that you're going to build your season coming up, your next good season on. Or you just got to swallow pride sometimes. And when those guys go dancing off up the hills in December and you're just sat there going, right, I'm staying here, then
Because I had somebody that they, you know, they'd beaten these various people. They went back into a group that's training now. And this group whipped the arse of this rider because, well, A, it wasn't a race. Nobody said race. They said you're coming out training. And B, they were going hell for leather to try and see how fast they could do this particular route. And then the person started questioning. So I said, they're beating me. I said, what month is it? Right, yeah, it's October. Did any of those people beat you in the season? Well, no, they didn't. But what's going wrong? Well, no, they carried on competing and they haven't gone, hold on a minute. I know it's a whatever day it was, a Tuesday. This isn't meant to be a race. There can be segments of that ride that you turn into hard effort, perhaps. You could do the whole thing and no effort. But it isn't who trains the fastest goes the fastest.
That's it,
if you are out of your zone consistently, not the average heart rate comes back as being in zone one. The majority of that zone one planned ride, because that's what you're going into it saying, am I racing? No, I'm not doing intervals tonight. I'm doing a planned zone one ride. So the majority of that session should be zone one. Okay, if you get it wrong, you get your route wrong, the weather's bad and you find that, you know, you have to work really hard, you go, right, that's not going to work next time. I need to think about, you know, taking on board that if it's going to be really windy, maybe that's the night to say, right, I'm going to ride into the wind hard. And then when I turn away from the wind, I'll get my easy bit, you know. But it isn't who trains the most often in zone two gets the best results. Actually, it's the exact opposite. And, you know, there's just so much data showing that nobody says you've got to do it all easy, but if you want to do some harder work, you didn't mention strength work. And I think with somebody doing 7-8 hours, you might find, you know, one of the days, if you can do some strength work, that might be possible in the gym, or do some strength work in doing a, you know, a turbo with some overgeared work at like 60 revs, really grind it out, and then get off and then just try and run, you know, as hilly as you can for 20 minutes and see that that can be your strength work.
Yeah.
But it isn't that you're trying to run threshold. You can do strength work without going flat out. People, you know, only think about hard work as opposed to working against resistance, but you're still being fairly aerobically controlled. You could do close to 50-mile time trial power, but if you do it at low revs, you won't get the heart rate that shows you're working hard, but your legs will tell you that you've done some work afterwards. And then what you get is a sense that you're building that aerobic and strength platform, which means that you're not necessarily having to do high-intensity work in order to think, well, where do I get my 20% high-intensity? Sometimes that, I think that high intensity is sometimes not even high intensity. It's hard work because it's just hard work for you to do that session.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, oh, that course, I just about stay in zone one. There's a few minutes I go out of it, but it's actually quite hard work. Well, great. You know, from your perceived exertion, that's more than zone two. But your actual numbers on the clock show you're in zone one most of the time.
Yeah. So just with reference to that, Dave, is don't be too obsessed or feeling guilty that you know, you sneak over the 80 on a couple of sessions, you know, as long as you're not there all the time, then it's not something.
Yeah.
Plus, it does make it more interesting.
Oh, it's great to feel strong and to do that kind of effort and go, yeah, cool, I felt good.
But there's other ways of being able to have a harder session without the heart rate going through the roof. Like Joe says, we're doing a bit of strength work as well, something a bit different, because then you're building everything. You're building this steady, stable block of not going into your zone two, and also kind of your strength in your legs. It all combines together. And then, yeah, it'll come through. But with your, don't panic too much about not having as much time as you would like. You know, just see how you get on this season, and then if that leads to your Ironman quest for 2014, then, you know, hopefully you'll have a sound building block and the knowledge to be able to turn it around, to be able to pick it up for the Ironman.
And I think to get the detail and to get a bit of feedback, really, for the sports lab heart rate, blah blah blah, what I'm going to suggest is I stick up a response to that on the Facebook page. And then it can be some details then that sometimes when people are listening to this and they, you know, say, oh, what was that? If I write it down, it's easier for people to get it right. And there's, you know, there's different ways to do it. I'm not going to say this is the only way you can do it, but there are certain ways, I think, or certain more economical ways, or certain ways where people have done tests and it's been perhaps not done in the best of ways, and they end up getting a load of kind of bump, not bump data, but it's kind of like, oh yeah, because that test affected that test, it's not quite as good.
Yeah.
So I'll put that up on the Facebook. We are up to a whopping 1.5 hours.
Now, this is value for money.
This is value for money, yes. Yes. Great. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here.
Not a problem.
Not a problem.
I shall look forward to my homework. was it my homework?
Assignment,
that's the one I'm looking for
so contact week. Us with your questions, either click contact@coachjoebeer.com or via the Twitter or via the Facebook page. What more can I say? Thank you for your input and for your questions, because actually I think we've done quite a good variety of things that are applicable to some people, and you know, as long as most of the people most of the time think that we're doing it mostly right.
Hopefully.
If not, you know, bring us up on something or say, you said you're going to do this, but you never did it, or expand upon
you this. Not lie.
You not lie. Or expand upon this, I'm interested in it. It's hard to cover so many different sports and people, but there's some fundamental principles that, even if it only jolts people or nudges them into thinking about it, maybe thinking about something else that they thought, actually, that relates to something completely different, but that it reminds them to do it. I think that's really good. This will be out in the middle of November. The next podcast will be out in early December. Please get your questions in. Thank you very much for listening. Remember, train smart and have fun. Test, test, test.
Boop, 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 be doop. Whatever your distance, whatever your event, podcast aims to make you smarter and faster.
Oh, you've learned that. Oh, I hope Henry puts this at the end, or this is going to confuse people.
How long has that taken me to do?
A long time. No.